How's that? We good? You guys hear me okay? Okay. Just leave it alone. All right, good. I noticed the next item on the schedule is see you next year. So I believe that means I got all the time I want. No, I'm going to keep an eye on the time, I promise you. I'm not going to keep anybody here too long. I know some of us are ready to get out of here. But, Greg, thank you for the introduction. And thank you for taping. You know, that's a big deal. That's a big deal to get that message out there. It's sometimes an underrated way of carrying this message. And I know there's a lot of men in this room that have been helped a whole lot by listening to some folks on tape. And I sure appreciate it. My name's Chad Payne. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. I'm sober since April the 2nd of 2003. And I got to tell you guys, I'm excited to be up here. This is a special one. It's a special one. It's a special time. Man to man's a special place. And I've had as much fun here at this conference as I've had anywhere in AA any time in my life. This is a special place. Sometimes when I do these talks, I'm in front of a whole bunch of people that I don't know and I may never see again. And the ego tries to rear its head and say, well, what about what they think about you? And I'm like, I don't care. I'll never see them again. I don't have that argument today. I want to say a couple things here, and if I get emotional, I tell you, I just want to warn you, I'm not a good crier from the podium, you know, and it involves a lot of loud nose blowing, and it's pretty ugly, but I'll try to get through it without that. But Charlie Parker was my sponsor for about 15 years and so much more. I mean, we were close. And last year I couldn't be here. As you guys know, he died right before this conference. And I got to spend his last, you know, 4 weeks or so with him and then stay another week or so there for the funeral. And then we had the funeral, and we have a special meeting there at the house, you know, his Thursday night meeting. When Man to Man comes around, it's a special meeting. It's a big meeting. And we had that right after the funeral. We left the funeral and went straight to the meeting. And I know a lot of you guys know that because I'm sure it was talked about last year. And I appreciate you guys putting leaving a seat open for him. That means a lot to me. But I had to get on back to New Jersey, so I couldn't make it last year. But what I want to tell you is that Charlie was kind of at the end, you know, and we were at his office. And if any of you guys ever went to Charlie's office, you know that was a special place for him. It was his home. He's got a home and then another home, and it's full of Dallas Cowboys memorabilia and AA memorabilia. If you walk in there, you'll go, well, this guy loves the Dallas Cowboys and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very obvious. And we're in his office, and Katie gives me the impossible task of saying, hey, hospice is going to be at the house at 1:30. Can you get Charlie there on time? No, Katie. Nobody can get Charlie anywhere on time. But the last thing that he did, and I had to help him, the last thing he did in that office was register for Man to Man. And then we walked out, and that was the last time that he was ever in there, you know. And I thought that was very fitting, because this is exactly what he taught us that AA is all about. It's Charlie was a step worker and a technician and a big book thumper, but above everything, you know, he loved alcoholics, and that's what he taught me and so many more, to love alcoholics and to be enthusiastic for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Whew, okay, we got through that part. Now I'll tell you some of my story. Well, before I do that, for Eric, that was a great talk Friday night. That's a way to kick it off, man. I tell you, you know, Al-Anons and AAs aren't always exactly alike, but a martyr is a victim with a mission. Woo, can I relate to that one? That hit me hard right here. And that was really great. And what an honor it is to get to walk up to this podium after Myers has been standing here. I mean, that's really special. And, you know, I think about what Primary Purpose Group did for me and has helped me you know, do for so many others, and it's overwhelming. You know, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude and humbled by getting to be a small part of that. Jack, I was telling Jack, sometimes I feel a little bit radical in business meetings when I'm saying things like, which pamphlets do we need to order? How about a big book? Why don't we clear that pamphlet table and put a big book on it? You know, that's, and they're like, oh, there goes Chad again with his big book stuff. So it's that was nice. Thank you for that talk last night, Jack. That's not an easy talk to give. You know, you, sometimes those kind of things ruffle some feathers, but there are a lot of things there that need to be said. So thank you. And all you guys that are service around here, thank you. And Tim, thanks for having me here. You know, this is real special, and all you guys that put this on. So I come from an alcoholic family. I mean, I wasn't abused; I was loved. But 5 out of 6 of us either are currently or at some time have been a member of a 12-step fellowship. You know, five out of six ain't bad, right? That's pretty good. And it's cool now because, you know, we sit around the table and at Thanksgiving or whatever, and we're real transparent with each other, and we talk about spirituality and things. But the events leading up to that were a little chaotic, you know. But you know, I mean, we had some good times, just like, you know, as we know, alcoholism, there's some good times, and then there's some bad times, and then there's less good times, and there's more bad times, and that's kind of how it was. But you know, I was doing pretty good as a kid, you know, and it was in the 80s, and we had a lot of fun. We kind of felt like we owned the small town where I grew up, Hugo, Oklahoma. Anybody know where that is? Right across the river from Paris, Texas. Yeah, I was actually tell people I was born in Paris, and they're like, "No, you weren't." I'm like, I swear to God, I was born in Paris. And you know, it's just because we didn't really have that good of a hospital in Hugo, so you had to cross the river to get born. So I can say I was born in Texas. That's right. I was doing pretty good as a kid playing sports and made pretty good grades in school and had friends and kind of was right in the middle of some good times, man. Some good times mowing yards, you know, around town with the gas can and those little clippers that you go around the fence with. That was the weed eater and. I mean, it was good times, but something happened to me right around, I don't know, 11, 12 years old. Something started to hit. So it's like there was a little voice that was constantly talking to me. It started out real quiet, just kind of a low hum. And then gradually, day after day, it got a little bit louder. And that voice would say things like, nobody really wants you around. You know, they're making fun of you when you're not looking. Or when you are looking. You don't fit in, you're not good enough. If you were more like this guy, then you'd be okay, you know. And I was backpacking a couple years ago in New Mexico. I was going through some hard times in sobriety and trying to kind of get clear on some stuff. And I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll load up a backpack and go hit the mountains and see if I can get some clarity. And I was up on a mountain by myself and I had this real weird experience, and my tears were flowing, and that doesn't happen that often for me. It does these days. Good God, it seems like I can't shut them down, but at that time it didn't. And I had this weird experience where I realized that what it was like, that voice that still comes around, it still comes back, and it would be like if a father figure was following me around all the time saying, you know, Chad, if you were more like Brian, then you'd be okay. If you were like, then you'd be okay. And you know, that would be considered abusive, but nobody was doing that to me but me, you know. And that's kind of what I was on. But you know what? Thankfully, I found an answer to that, and a real simple answer. You know, I get a few drinks in me, and that voice shuts up. I get a few drinks in me, and I don't regret the past. You know, I get a few drinks on me, and I'm no longer tripping about the future. I get a few drinks in me, and everything's okay. Everything's okay. Now, I didn't know that at the time. What I knew at the time was drinking was fun. It was just a lot of fun. What I know today that I didn't know then is that life is amazing. It's absolutely amazing when I can be present and experience it, but I couldn't. I couldn't because I didn't live in the world. I lived in my head. But alcohol brought me out of my head into the world. In that sense, it was the closest thing I ever knew to a spiritual experience. And if you listen to a lot of AA talks, you're going to hear a lot of AA speakers say something real similar to that. But the interesting thing is that's not what makes me alcoholic. That is a common experience among human beings in this world. I know I was a teacher for about 12 years, and I worked with a lot of troubled teenagers, and it was a very common experience for them to feel really uncomfortable in their skin and to take a few drinks, smoke a joint, get a couple pills, whatever, and get something in their system, and all of a sudden they feel a lot better, you know. So if that's not what makes me alcoholic, then what is? It's that funny relationship I have with alcohol, right? And what that looks like for me is once I start to drink, I lose control. And I'll tell you a quick story about what that looks like in my life. At this time in my life, I've got a wife and a kid and a home. That wasn't always the case. But at this time, I've got a wife and a kid and a home, and I work construction, and I work on the road a lot. And I'd just gotten back from a job, and, you know, things are good. I got a pocket full of money. I'm at home. My wife and I are getting along, which was the exception, not the rule. And I'll tell you why. We got together because we partied together. We partied the same way, and we were a real good fit. And then she got pregnant, or we got pregnant, or whatever you're supposed to say. I don't know. I can see how they could both be a little offensive, you know. And we made a commitment. We're going to straighten up. You know, we're going to straighten up. We're going to cut out all this partying and this drinking and this lifestyle we've been living, and we're going to be good parents. You know? And she did. And I meant to. And that's not a lie. I meant to. I really did. But what that created was a very... Well, let's just say we fought a lot. We fought a lot, and I was wrong every time. But on this night, we weren't fighting. You know, we were getting along well. We're watching a movie. My little daughter's playing on the floor. And my wife says to me, hey, you know, it's getting late. I'm going to put her to bed. Well, I'll put her to bed. Why don't you go get us a bite to eat? When you get back, we'll finish watching this movie. I'm like, cool, I'll do it. And I'm walking out the door, and I turn around to her with a smile. Along. This is cool. This is rare, you know. It's a good night. And I look at her, and I say, I'll be back in 20 minutes. And you got, do you know what's coming? I mean, you could have said, Chad, do you swear to God you'll be back in 20? Absolutely. And I'm not lying. I meant it, you know, and I'm going to get us some tacos and driving. And then I have this thought. And the thought is, you know, been doing good, got work, got a pocket full of money, everything's going well. Tomorrow, when my wife... She was back in college. When she goes to class, I'll get my daughter up and get her ready, and we'll have some quality time, and then I'll take her to daycare, and I'll go pick up my buddy Michael, and, you know, we'll ice down some beer, and I had a four-wheel drive pickup and some guns, you know, and we'll go get in the mud and shoot some gun. We'll have a good time, and then I'll come home, and we'll watch another movie and hang out with my family. And it's all good. So I go get the tacos, and then on the way back, I'm like, well, you know what? I'm going to swing by Michael's house for just a second and let him know I'm coming tomorrow. So I stop by. The truck's running. Diesel pickups, just leave it running. I knock on the door, and he answers the door, and he answers it with a bottle of Jaeger, smoking meth off tinfoil. I mean, you know, just a typical night. Nothing weird about that. And he says, come on in, man. We're having a good time. I'm like, no, I'm not. I can't. I'm not doing that. I got to get home. But tomorrow I'm going to come. He's like, come on in just for a minute. You know, people want to. I'm like, oh, hey, look. And I go in the house, and we're past the point of no return. You know, next thing I know, it's midnight. And the thought that comes to my mind is, well, I can't go home now, because if I go home now, I'll be in big trouble. Now, if that makes sense to you, welcome to AA. The truth is, if I'd have gone home then, I'd have been in trouble, but I could have salvaged the situation. And that's not what happened. Next thing I know, it's daylight, and I'm telling Michael, bro, we got to go, because if we don't get out of here, she's going to come find me, and she's going to have my daughter in tow, and there's going to be a big scene, and somebody's probably going to call the cops, and that's a big deal. So what happens is my 20-minute trip to get tacos takes 2 weeks. And it's not like I come home in 2 weeks. It's like 2 weeks later, I get caught sneaking my golf clubs out of the garage at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, so that's how I show up as a dad, and that's how I show up as a husband, and that's how I show up in this world when I lose control over my drinking. So that's the first problem I have, and it's real simple. Once I start drinking, all bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen next. And the easy answer to that is, well, Chad, if bad stuff happens when you drink, don't drink. Okay? Well, the next story I want to tell you is about my first surrender to alcohol. My first surrender to alcohol, if you fast forward a little ways down the road, things have gotten a little worse. We ain't getting along ever anymore. Things have gotten a little worse, and I have a wreck. I run my truck. I fell asleep. I mean, I was under the influence. I fell asleep driving and hit a tree, hit a boat arc tree. And when I tell this story in some places, they don't even know what I'm talking about. I hit a boat arc tree about this big around. I've never heard of a boat arc tree this big around. I mean, this big around would have totaled my truck. This thing was huge. I looked at it a while after the wreck. I was like, where in the hell did that thing come from? I veered off the left side of the road in a pickup and hit it at about 70 miles an hour. Somebody told me about that, who happened to be behind me. And I didn't know what happened, but it took them about an hour and a half to get me out of the truck. And I spent about a month in the hospital. I had a bunch of broken bones it's funny. I ran into one in a small town. I ran into one of the guys a few years later that was there that rescued me, and I don't remember any of it. And I asked him about it, and I said, "Well, was I unconscious that whole time?" He said, "Oh, no. You were conscious. You were fully alert, and you were giving us real clear instructions on how to get you out." I bet I was. Thank you. Thank you for putting up with me and saving my life. I had a broken hip and pelvis and my jaw, and my head was busted up, and my big dysfunctional family that I had pushed out of my life, they showed up, you know. They showed up at the hospital. They stayed with me. Just to kind of give you an idea of the kind of family I come from. Like, if you ask me how many brothers and sisters I have, that's not an easy question. I mean, we're talking like who counts and who doesn't. Are we talking step, half, adopted? One time I told a story. I said, very tragic story. I said, you know, my sister's brother died in a car wreck when he was 14. And somebody said, isn't your sister's brother your brother? Well, I guess technically, I mean, I don't know. It's a good question. And I know in that room at one point, in that hospital room, at one point my dad was in there with his wife and his ex-wife and my mom. Yeah. And, you know, but they showed up for me. I'd pushed them out of my life at this point, but they showed up for me. And we had some really powerful conversations during that time. And I looked a lot of my family in the eye. And I told him, I said, I'm done. I'm done living this way. Because this wreck wasn't just a one-time event. This was kind of, what do you say, like the straw that broke the camel's back or something like that. And there have been a lot of bad things leading up to this. And I had my first surrender to alcohol. Look, my dad and he had tears in his eyes. I'd never seen that before. It was real uncomfortable. And I said, Dad, I swear to God, I'm done. And on that day, I quit drinking. And I got out of the hospital, and I got crutches over here, but I haven't graduated to the crutches yet. At the moment, I'm on a walker. My jaws are wired shut. I'm just kind of getting around like this, and the family's showing. They're setting things up for me, you know, give me a place here to stay and a chair where I can try to sleep in it, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Everything that I eat's going to have to go through that blender, you know, and we're trying to figure out how. And you know, people really showed up for me, and I cut all that. I quit drinking, and I lasted 2 days. I made it 2 days. And 2 days later, I'm out all night partying on a walker with my jaws wired shut. And I don't know if any of you ever had your jaws wired shut or been around anybody with their jaws wired shut, but this is what it's like. And when you're out all night partying, trying to get a word in with your friends, it's a little frustrating. So, like anybody with any sense, she took my daughter and she left. She said, "This is the craziest thing I've ever seen. I'm out of here," and it was long overdue. And that began the quitting days. And then I quit drinking again and again and again and again. And if it was real bad, sometimes I could make it, a couple days, and otherwise I could make it till evening, and that's kind of what it looked like. And the consequences went from what I just described to you to the homeless guy that nobody wanted around that would steal from the easy targets, like grandma when she's in the nursing home recovering from a stroke, the easy targets. And that's what I came to. So my mom, she's the Al-Anon of the family. She organized an intervention. Any of you guys ever been a part of an intervention? Anybody ever done that? That's a hard thing to do. She organized this intervention, but she organized this intervention and got hired an interventionist and got a bed in a treatment center and did all those things, and she did it for my brother. And my brother walked in and saw all these folks sitting in a circle, and he said, "Hell no, I'm out." And he walked out, and that was the end of that, And so she said, "Well, we got a bed in a treatment center. I guess we might as well try Chad." But what you guys know that she didn't know is I was much more likely, because I was in a really bad spot. But, most people don't know that kind of thing. There's a lot of things that seem to kind of contradict the normal way of thinking that we experience in here. But she did this, and she tricked me. She pulled a pretty good trick on me. She got word to me through some other people that I had a paycheck waiting on me at her office that no one could get to me, but she had it. And if I would show up on this day at this time, I could pick up that paycheck. Now, I hadn't had a job in a couple years. And I knew that. But just by chance that there was a paycheck, I really needed the money. So I showed up, and here's a bunch of people sitting in a circle. And now back to the difficulty of an intervention. Here are some people who, on one hand, would really like to save my life, and on the other hand, would really like to choke me out. They love me and they hate me at the same time. But not only that, some of them hate each other. Right? That's the kind of family I come from. And they had to do something really uncomfortable. They had to travel a long ways, gather up in a circle, write these really uncomfortable letters, and sit there on the chance that my dumbass would show up thinking I had a check when nobody had heard from me in who knows how long. And they did all this in an effort to save my life. And I walked in that door, and I saw them sitting in that circle, and the first thought that comes to my mind is, how could they do this to me? Now, just on a side note, I got a quiz question for you. Do you think that level of self-centeredness goes away because you remove the alcohol from me? No. As a matter of fact, it gets worse. Unbelievably, it actually gets worse. I tend to be less selfish when I'm half drunk all the time. You get me sober and watch out. So I agreed. I agreed to go to this little treatment center. I don't know what we did there. Probably a bunch of stuff that doesn't work for alcoholics, but they introduced me to you. They took me to meetings, and I found my people. And they told me, I don't know what all they told me in that. They might have told me everything that I know today about, for all I know. But all I heard was go to meetings and get in the middle, get involved. 90 meetings in 90 days. Do you guys know that 90 meetings in 90 days thing actually came from the Salvation Army? I've been saying, I don't even know where that comes from. And somebody finally came up to me in the receiving line and said, "Oh, it's from the Salvation Army when they expanded their program to go for 90 days. If you could stay 90 days if you went to a meeting every day." It's like, I'll be damned. That's where 90 and 90 comes from, Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and to get involved. And I got out of there, and I didn't really know what it meant to be alcoholic, but here's what I did know. I did know that I'd do anything not to go back to the way I'd been living, because it was bad. And where I come from, I didn't know anybody that had ever been to AA or had ever been sober and relapsed or had ever been to rehab. We just joked about it. We're like, man, that boy needs to go to rehab. I don't know what it is, but he needs to go to rehab, you know. I didn't have any idea what any of it was. But so it was all brand new stuff to me, and I knew I didn't want to go back to the way I'd been living. So I left that place. I moved to Oklahoma City, and I got in the middle, man. I started going to meetings every day. I mean, I went to work for a painter in AA for $8 an hour, and we called it Jeff's Halfway House Painting because everybody he hired came out of AA, and they would come and go pretty quick. You know, well, he's a no-show. We may never see him again, you know. And I mean, I'm going, and sometimes, you know, on a rough day, I'd call into work and go to 3, 4, 5. I actually had a 5-meeting circuit I could do in one day. Now, at the time, I thought that was pretty responsible. My boss thought it was a little selfish. And I was right in the middle of AA. You know, I was staying sick, but I was staying sober. And I mean, I was showing up early and I was staying late and I was chairing meetings, cleaning out ashtrays, moving chairs around. I was doing all that was going on. Where I went to meet, we weren't real good at the self-supporting part. So we were having fundraisers. We didn't know you weren't supposed to do that. I was involved in all those. Most of our committees were about raising funds, you know. It was not the most responsible Alcoholics Anonymous that you'll ever come across. And I was right in the middle of all of it. I was hanging out with sober people. Waffle House was a real popular place. You could eat your eggs and smoke cigarettes at the same time. It was great. But about a year into this, I started getting tired of you guys, you know. I tell you, hang around AA long enough without a program and we'll drive somebody to drink. And what my AA experience turned into was something like, all right, I've been through work all day, my girlfriend's acting crazy, my money's all messed up, and I got to go to this, I don't even like this meeting, oh, tonight's this meeting, let's go to this meeting. And this one guy's probably going to share about this divorce or whatever it is, I'm going to listen to that again, and you know, and then I'd be in the meeting like, well, there's Tim. Tim always says some good stuff, and then nobody calls on Tim, and I'm just furious. I'm like, come on, that's my relief, because I got to get home and have enough relief to get in. And you know what happened? I got about ready to leave AA. I wasn't going to drink. I'm all about being sober. I wasn't going to go back to that old way of life. But I didn't need AA anymore. It was really bugging me. And then one night I'm chairing a meeting, and this guy shows up. He's from out of town. He's from Las Vegas. He shows up, and he's sitting in the meeting. And I've been trained as a good member of AA. After the meeting, I'm going to go talk to him and talk, you know, see where he's from and talk, have a little short conversation with him, welcome him, and then go hang out with my friends. And that little short conversation turned into about a 2-hour conversation on the front steps of that meeting. And what he did is he 12-stepped me. About a year into sobriety, he 12-stepped me. And it was not a good conversation. He didn't share his experience, strength, and hope with me. He shared hopelessness. He shared hopelessness. First, he identified. He did that process of identification. He told me some stories about himself, and I knew that we were just alike. And then using his experience, he helped me to understand what alcoholism is. And I was very disturbed. And he's got me sitting there very quietly, just kind of shaking my head, because what I had realized is that I was not about to walk out of AA and stay sober, that there was a good chance I was going to walk out of AA and drink. And guys, just below the surface, I knew that. He wasn't telling me something I didn't know. I was just fooling myself, because I had seen it happen over and over and over. At the kind of groups I was going to, I was the old timer. Nobody was staying around that long. It was a revolving door, you know. And I saw, that's just going to be me. I'm going to do the same thing. And he let me sit in that for a little while. And he said, you know, Chad, I think I know what you need. I was like, what, Dave? What do I need? He said, I think you need a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps. And that seemed so profound. I remember thinking, I know about that. I have that reading memorized. I go to a lot of meetings, you know. There's no way for a newcomer to look cooler in AA than to set the card down and do the reading by memory. I just feel so bad when the guy messes it up, you know, and he's like, oh, man, you almost had it, bud. So we worked the steps. I had a little problem working the steps because I definitely did not believe in God. And he kept talking about God. And that was a little bit of a struggle for me. You know, I kind of came up. Mom took us to church. When I was a kid, Mom took us to church on holidays and when she felt guilty. All right, that was kind of my religious experience growing up. And I remember sitting in a church as a little kid looking around the room while the preacher's talking and going, come on, you people believe this stuff? Like, I'm 9 and I know this isn't true. And that's what I brought to you in AA. Welcome, yeah, welcome to AHA. There you go. That's my conception of God. And I just thought, it wasn't just like Christianity. I'm not one of those that had a resentment against the church or what. I just thought meditation, the great spirit, you know, you name it. If it had to do, I thought it was ridiculous. I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. Maybe it was for some of you idiots that believed it or whatever. But I had something real special going for me. What I had going for me was I was very clear that left to my own power, I was going to pick up a drink and go back to the way of life I'd been living. So I did have a step two problem, and I sponsor a lot of guys today that have a problem with step two, a big problem with God. And I love those guys. I love it when someone comes to me and says, I really got a problem with this spiritual thing. And I'm like, come here, buddy. Hey, come on. Yeah, you know, I love that. And I tell them, I go through them. You know, I have some understanding. We talk about some things. But basically what it comes down to is this. I tell them the same thing. And here's what it is. If you got a step two problem, welcome to AA. About half of us do. Since the first day of Alcoholics Anonymous, about half of us have a problem with God. Dr. Bob was like, cool, bring it on. And Bill was like, I don't know about this God thing. And ever since then, it's been about, so if you got a step two problem, come on in. It's going to work great for you. But if you got a step two problem that keeps you from working the rest of the steps, that's not a step two problem, that's a step one problem. And what I mean by that is if I'm clear on the hopelessness of alcoholism and you want me to pray, I'll pray. As a matter of fact, I tell you, I got a problem with step 4, 5, 9. Got a big problem with that one. 12, that's a little inconvenient. I got lots of step problems. But I got a clear understanding of what's wrong with me. And that drives me through the rest of this. And I love what I heard. That I have to do this until I want to do it, and then I don't have to do it anymore. That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to fast forward a little ways down the road and talk about at 5 years sober, I moved to Austin. And I was looking around for some AA. I'd kind of gotten to be a part of some AA in Oklahoma City that was good, responsible, tradition-driven, you know, home groups, and it was some good AA. And we were studying the Big Book and the 12 and 12, and you know, we had some pretty good stuff going. And it was real important to show up and you know, demonstrate what a principled, God-reliant man looks like and be of service at your home group and do all those things. And I was down there in Austin. I was in a new place, and I was looking for some groups like that. And I kept finding myself in places where people weren't really there. The shares would be a lot of stuff like, I know I should be doing this, but I'm not, and I'm experiencing a lot of fear, and thanks for letting me share. You know, and I was getting frustrated, and I heard this guy talk about some stuff coming out of this book that sounded pretty, pretty serious, you know. And I went to him after the meeting, and you can hear the frustration in my voice as I said, I got to ask you a question. Where are the people who take this thing too seriously? Where are those people? Let me put it this way. Where are like the AA Nazis? And he goes, oh, man, you got to go down to Primary Purpose Group and meet Charlie and Katie. He's like, all right. And then around the same time, there was this little gangster dinner somebody put on, and Charlie was the speaker. And, And then I ended up asking Katie to come speak at this little group I was a part of, and all this stuff kind of started coming together. And I went in Primary Purpose Group, and I remember I'm sitting in this room, about, I don't know, 200 people in the room. They're using a study guide that's non-conference approved literature. I'm like, what are they doing in here? You can't do this in AA. And then I remember there was a woman who I have no idea who she was, and Blind Dave. And it was, the topic was, we were somewhere on pages 87, 88, somewhere in there. And they were sharing about what they do for the 11th step. And I'm going, I don't do that. And it says it right here in the book. And that hit me right in the pride. You guys know what I'm talking about? When it hits you right, I'm like, okay, I got to come back here. And really quickly, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the enthusiasm, not just for being a member of AA, but the enthusiasm for studying this book, learning it, doing what it says, and carrying its message, and the miracles that happen as a result of it. I fell in love with it. But at the time, I had no idea what I was getting into. Charlie was telling me on Thursday night, we have a meeting at my house, my sponsor's there and some of my sponsees, and I want you to come. And I was like, you know, I got a commitment on Thursday night at this little meeting. I've got a service position. It's on the UT campus, and there's a lot of cute girls in there. And, you know, and he twisted my arm finally and got me at that table, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I had no idea that I was getting into some AA. And then years down the road, I would speak in different places around the country, and I would tell that story, and people would come to me, and they would say, you sat at the table with Mark Houston in Charlie and Katie's house? You were there? I'm like, yeah, I was there. I was there, not for very long, but I was there. You know, and I had no idea. I had no idea what was going on at that time, and how special that was. And this weekend, I'm so humbled and so grateful to know that I get to be somewhere in the middle of that message coming down and coming to me and lighting me on fire and revolutionizing my recovery. And then I get to pass that on, and I get to see some of these guys sitting in here, and they're doing the same thing and carrying that message. And I'm just sitting here crying like a baby in front of a bunch of grown men. Wow, what a gift. You know, and I'm a closed-minded alcoholic, and they were talking about things that I didn't know about, and I wasn't really sure if I agreed with. Because where I come from, it's a little bit different. Where I came from, I'll just give you an example. You share your experience, strength, and hope with a new guy, but they were talking about a fatal dose of alcoholism. They were talking about that being the greatest gift that I could ever give an alcoholic, is to shatter all hope that he can get this job done on his own. Wow. And they gave me a simple, straightforward, systematic way to lay out alcoholism. And I tell you, I was up in New Jersey, and we're at this place, this treatment center, where everybody's still pretty doped up, sitting in their chairs, all laid back, their hoods on, their heads down, and I'm in there with the person who facilitates it, and then this woman's in there, and she's pretty new, and she goes first, and she's talking to them, and she's got a strong message, and ain't nobody listening to it. And they get, and it gets over to me. I'm not saying this is spiritual, you know. I'm not about to tell you that God, you know, inspired me to do this. But I tell you, I had on a little jacket, I took that jacket off, and I stood up, and I got in the middle of that room, and I said, what I'm about to tell you is the most important information you're ever going to hear. And by God, I don't know if they loved me or hated me, but they perked up and listened. And that's really how I feel about it. That's really how I feel. The greatest thing I was ever told is what's wrong with me, because that set me on a path. And if an alcoholic clearly knows what's wrong with him, it just opens the door to all kinds of spirituality, because he wants it. Because he wants it. And he knows he's got to have it. And who knows what happens next. It's unbelievable. So another thing I learned. I thought the third step, and I've heard it said in here, in this room, I thought the third step was real simple. It's a decision and a prayer. Are you alcoholic? Yes, I am. Okay. Do you believe in God? Yeah, okay. Well, then make the decision. Turn your willing life over to God and let's say a third strip prayer and we're going to write inventory. And my God, Charlie sent me down in my apartment and he opened the book to page 60 and started with ABC and took me line by line through pages 60 to 63 and he blew my mind. And everything he was talking about, I was about 5 years sober, and everything he was talking about, I thought that part of the book was about when I was drinking. It's not. It's not at all. And it happens to me over and over. I read parts of this book and I think, there is no way Bill knew how much this was going to apply to a guy with 20 years of sobriety. There's no way. This book is so divinely inspired. And it speaks to you when you're brand new and can't stop drinking. And it almost speaks to you even more when you're a long time sober and living a life of sobriety. And he started talking to me about this third step. And what I've learned over the years about this third step is really, here's the deal. In the first step, I find out that I have a hopeless, progressive, fatal illness. And there's not a thing I can do about it. Because see, when I told you guys about me coming into AA early on and how I knew I didn't want to live that way anymore, and people in the room raised their hand and said, I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, no problem. My name's Chad. I'm an alcoholic. Now, had you asked me what that meant, I would have told you some stories about my drinking, but that's about the best I could do. But I guarantee you, if there is such a thing as an alcoholic, I'm one of them, right? That's got to be true. But here's what I really knew. What I really knew is that I'm a drunk. And there's a big difference in a drunk and an alcoholic. A drunk has a problem. An alcoholic doesn't have an answer. And that realization makes all the difference in the world. Because as long as I have a problem, my next thought is, and I'll get a handle on that, starting tomorrow. But once I'm clear that I'm alcoholic and I don't have an answer, I become interested in your answer. Right? So I find out in the first step I've got this hopeless, progressive, fatal illness called alcoholism. And then in the second step, I find out that there is an answer for that. There is an answer. And you know what? I'll just read it to you. Here's what it says right here. It says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only 90 meetings in 90 days. No, it's not. Which only a spiritual experience will conquer. The solution is a spiritual experience. That's the solution to alcoholism. There's not a spiritual side to AA. AA is a spiritual program, period. But the important thing about the third step that I had been missing, and I'm not the only one, is that in the first thing I learned in the third step is that I can't have a spiritual experience. Why can't I have one? Because I'm blocked. Nobody comes into AA and says, please help me, I'm so self-centered. That's not why we come in. That's not what gets us in the door. But why is it so important that we talk so much about this failure of self-will? Because that's what blocks me from the only solution there is to alcoholism. When I'm living on self-will, I can't wake up the spirit. What I learned is that I don't have a relationship with life. I have a sick relationship with the way I think life should be. And I'm obsessed with it. It's normal to have preferences. I'm obsessed with my preferences. It's all I ever think about. I mean, you know, I like country music. Not that country music they play on the radio. I like that alternative country, or that stuff they played back in those days, but not them. How about music is wonderful, Chad? Just show up and experience it. Okay, that's kind of a dumb example. My taste in music's not killing me. But I take that philosophy and apply it to everything in life. thank God for AA, it saved my life. 2 weeks later, I don't like that kind of meeting. I like this kind of meeting, and I need to go here, and these people are doing this wrong and that. That's where I live in my mind. This girl, man, she's the solution to everything. I love her. She's perfect. We're soulmates. A few months down the road, you're not going to believe what she's doing. This is wrong, and, you know, and that's just kind of where I live. The book says I'm a victim of the delusion that I can be happy and satisfied if I can just manage everything well. Here's what that means to me. I remember sitting around with some guys and reading that. We're reading it, right? I said, what does that line mean? I think it means that if I get everything I want, then I'll be happy. The guy's like, yeah, that is, I think that is what it means. I'm like, well, yeah. What's wrong with that? How's that a delusion? And what I understand today is that that leaves me with two scenarios. Scenario number one, I don't get what I want, and then I can't be happy. Well, that's no way to live. That kind of makes me a victim of circumstances. Or scenario number two, I do get what I want, now I'm happy for about 10 minutes, and then I need something else. There's a guy sitting in this room that I dearly love who said to me on the, he set it up perfectly. I mean, I love when a 10-step call sets up this way. He calls me up and he said, man, if she would just work a program, everything would be fine. In my mind, I'm like, mark the date. This is going to be good. Down the road a little ways, he's calling me up and he's going, man, all she ever does is talk to her sponsees. I'm like, hey, bud, do you remember when you said... So the big book refers to that in a few different ways. I'm arranging my life to suit me. But the one I like is that it calls it playing God. What's it look like to play God? When I first heard that, I thought that meant that I was trying to act like I'm the judge of, you know. But here's what it means to play God. It means that I spend all my time thinking about how life ought to be. And I don't experience the life God has given me. And the truth is, I can't experience God while I'm playing God. And that's what it really comes down to. Yeah. And it's interesting. Apparently, they thought this was pretty important. There's a couple lines I really like here in the book. Bill talked about what was going on after Abby took him through the steps. And he talks about entering a new relationship, upon a new relationship with his creator. Okay, I want that. That sounds good. I want a new relationship with my creator. But check out this one. This one's really good. How about a way of living which answered all my problems? I want that. I got a lot of problems. I want this. What's that way of living? I want that. He goes on over here a couple lines later. Say, simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. So if I want a new relationship with my Creator and I want a way of living, solve all my problems, there's a price I have to pay. And what is that price? And right here it says it meant destruction of self-centeredness. What? Destruction of self-centeredness. That's that word my mom's been using on me all the time. Self-centered my whole life. I went to her one time after I'd just done some inventory. I said, you know, Mom, I've been talking to my sponsor. I found out I've been pretty self-centered. She goes, really? I had no idea. But check this one out. This is one that really gets me. And this line, I mean, I think this line kept me up at night. And I'm going to read it to you the way Charlie read it to me. He said, it's on page 62 in the big book, right in the middle of the page, and it's my favorite line in the big book. But here's how Charlie read it to me. He said, above everything, we alcoholics must stop drinking vodka. I said, Charlie, that's not what it says. And he goes, I'm just making sure you're paying attention. But check this out. If I were to go to pop quiz, let's do a AA pop quiz. Let me do a little survey. Let's call it a survey. I'm going around and do a survey and go around and got people in AA and say, as an alcoholic in recovery, what's the most important thing you got to do? Above everything, there's some of us that would say, well, you got to stay sober. Not in this room. In this room, we're like advanced AA, right? We know better than that. One of my favorite things that we ever had in our little group was Tim was talking about doing advanced AA. He said, you know, we're trying to do advanced AA. And it turns out advanced AA is really basic. Advanced AA is where you follow the instructions in the book.
That's the advanced class.
But what about this? What if when I survey, but above everything, what's the most important thing? How many of us would say you got to develop a relationship with God? Spiritual awakening, right? That's not what it says. This is bizarre. Listen to this. It says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. What? What's that got to do with it? Rid of this selfishness? What self? The selfishness that it's specific. It says this, the selfishness has been laid out here on pages 60, 61, and 62, which is all about me trying to arrange life in a way to suit me. It's like somewhere along the way, I gave my mind a job. I don't know when it happened. I said, okay, mind, here's your new job. I want you to arrange life where I never have to experience any discomfort or inconvenience. And my mind's been working on it ever since, like in overdrive. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm like, would you shut up? And my mind's going, you gave me the job. It's not my fault I can't figure it out in the daytime hours. This selfishness that they've laid out here, above everything, I must be rid of this. And this is why a guy who's as agnostic and atheist as I am can have an experience with God. Because what happens is as we do this work that's laid out in the book, the natural result is self-centeredness begins to go down. And as self-centeredness goes down, another automatic thing happens. God consciousness goes up. So the way that I understand this today is this is not a program of doing something to experience God. It's a program of undoing something to experience God. And I'll hear people say it. I'm real good with the spiritual side of AA. Every morning I read about 9 meditation books and I sit with my legs crossed with my hands out like this, focusing on my breath and clearing my mind for about 45 minutes. And then I say the 11-step prayer and the 7-step prayer and the 3rd-step prayer and the Lord's prayer. And I go about my day. So I'm real good with the spiritual side of the program. I'm just not real good with the inventory part. And I'm like, bro, that is the spiritual side of the program. If you want to experience God in this program, you got to get clear what's blocking you from God. You got to. Or you won't experience it. Now, I got to say, I'll say this from up here. I read something interesting. It really got me to thinking. Bill wrote somewhere, he said something like, Dr. Bob was not quite as neurotic as some of the rest of us. He just really loved the grog. I think we should still call alcohol grog. That's a pretty cool name for alcohol. But I thought it was interesting. It got me to thinking, there are some folks in AA who come in, surrender, work the steps, start being of service, start a good life of prayer and meditation, find a woman, get married, have babies, buy a house, and live happily ever after. And then there's the rest of us. We come in, we surrender, we work the steps, we start getting in these disciplines, we start helping people, and game on. Welcome to living life on planet Earth. Here come the relationships. Here comes the finances. Here comes the rest of the world coming at me. And oh boy. Now, if you're brand new, close your ears. And we find out that sober wasn't the answer. And we got a lot of work to do, right? But the thing is, not everybody's like that. Now, all the guys in here that I sponsor, you're in that category, okay? I just want you to know. I can tell you. If you're wondering, I can tell you. Sometimes the danger, though, and this is what happens to me, I think I'm more in the Dr. Bob camp, and I'm not. I'm way more over on the depression, well, years into sobriety, kind of that camp, So thankfully, we've got some things in place for somebody like me that really can keep me growing well into sobriety. And another thing that I learned when I got to Austin and got in the middle of this AA that this continually working the steps throughout your sobriety kind of AA. I love it because the way that we do this is when we got a new guy coming in, if he's got the willingness, we're going to blaze you through the steps as quickly as you're willing to go and get you out there helping people. And then as you're doing that and you're ready to kill the woman and yourself because the relationship is such a struggle, we have a very deep, thorough way of going through the inventory process and digging up some deep-seated old ideas and character defects. And that's beautiful. I love that. You know, now let's see how deep we can go with this. And I need both. I need both. And we're going to keep on working these steps. And what Mark would talk about, I sit right here at the table, Charlie on that side, Mark on that side. Charlie would just do a little some kind of topic or something and get Mark going. And I'm just sitting there going, I'm like that, remember that Memorex commercial where the guy's getting his hair blown back, sitting in the chair with him. I'm just sitting there looking at you. Are you getting this? What is this guy talking about? You know, he's talking about taking the word watch and working with the word watch for 6 months. And I'm just, what? This is blowing my mind. But what I learned is let's not just do, you know, a quick run through 10 and 11 and, you know, okay, in the morning I'm going to read the 24-hour day book and say the third step prayer and then go on about my day, and at night I'll turn to page, you know, page 86 and go through those. Okay, cool, good there. Let's see if we can go deep. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, Stephen and I were going out to Lake Travis and doing some rock climbing up on the cliffs, and it's really cool, man. You get 20 foot up the cliffs, you can't go any further. You're just going in the water, man. It's fun. It's exciting. And I got into rock climbing. So while I'm at work, I got a five-minute break, and I shouldn't be doing something. I'm sneaking, watching a YouTube video on climbing. It's like really cool. And I'm like on Amazon, where I'm going to buy this different stuff. I'm getting climbing shoes and trying to getting on, trying to find different places. I'm into it, right? I'm into climbing. What if I take that into steps 10 and 11? Let's just see how far we can go with this. Because, see, I got a mind that tells me, man, if you really get into rock climbing and become a rock climber, then you'll be free and happy. And what you guys are telling me is that, man, if you'll really go deep in meditation and inventory and prayer and working with others, you'll find freedom and happiness there. And that's what I need, because I'm alcoholic, and anything I put above what we do in this program, I'll make a big old mess of. Right? So the last thing I want to tell you in the 35 minutes, I'm just kidding. The last thing I want to tell you in the couple minutes I have left, one more thing that I learned, and I want to kind of wrap it up on this. The thing that I learned, I came from some good responsible AA in Oklahoma when I got down to Austin. And the philosophy on sponsorship was this. You show up at your home group. You present yourself as a recovered man of AA. If someone new walks in the room, you introduce yourself to this guy. You give him your phone number. You make him feel welcome, right? And then hopefully this guy will call you, and you can talk, and then he'll ask you to sponsor him, right? And there is nothing wrong with any of that stuff. I still do all those things today, except for one thing. One thing was wrong with it. And I found this out sitting at that darn table that would ruffle my feathers over and over, because Katie comes in after the meeting and she starts quizzing us. And I hadn't experienced this before. I've experienced it many times since. She would let us know how shallow we are as men. I can't believe that's as deep as you guys go with this. Are you kidding me? I've said many times, I don't know who's in charge of picking speakers next year, but in my opinion, you need to have Katie up here. There's nothing a room full of men need more than some strong women in AA telling us how to take this to another level. Here's the quick quiz question she has on this night. She says, so how many people are you sponsoring? How many people are you sponsoring? She comes to me, she says, how many people are you sponsoring? Now, at this point in my sobriety, 5 years sober, I had had either zero, one, or two at a time. That was my experience. And at the time, I don't know, I had probably zero or one or something. I said that to her, and she said, with 5 years, you ought to be sponsoring 10 guys. I was like, that's ridiculous. You sponsor 10 guys, 5 years, 10 guys. And then you know what? It's like when it hits you in the pride. It hit me in the ego. Said, "Oh no, my the ego came alive." It said, "By God, next time I'm in this room and she asks me how many people I'm sponsoring, it will be 10." And I went on a mission. I went to the worst clubhouses that I, you know, with the worst reputation. I went to any time anybody was going into this institution, this treatment center, this jail, whatever it was, I'm in, I'm going. And every meeting I'm sitting there, I'm sharing something straight out of the big book, straight, you know, looking around the room. Where's my guy? Where's my, oh, this guy. So, you know, we're praying, I'm running over there and talking to guys and having these conversations. And then Charlie pointed out to me that it tells me exactly how to talk. This guy starts in the middle of page 91 with "see your man alone if possible." And I would talk to this new guy and sit out. And, you know, sometimes it went nowhere. Sometimes it really went somewhere. We have this good conversation. And then I would go get in the car. I couldn't even wait till I got home. And I'd open page 91. I'd see how I did. I'm like, oh, man, I forgot that. Oh, I wasn't supposed to do this until we did that. And it came alive, man. It came alive. And this was 100% ego-driven. I fully admit it. And God used it. God used my ego to revolutionize my recovery, to save my life, and to help a lot of guys. And next thing you know, I do have 10 sponsees. And my talks with Charlie are no longer, it's been 2 days and she didn't text me back. They turn to, I got this guy, and he's got to go home to a wife who's still drinking. What do I say to him? And I got this guy, and this is what's going on with him. And how do I help this guy? And this guy has trouble with this thing, and what do I do here? And how do we approach this amends? And it got me out of me, and I start thinking about these guys, and the craziest thing happened. I had heard this word in AA called compassion. I didn't know what it meant. I could tell you what it meant, but I hadn't experienced what it meant. And when I started helping these guys, I started just a little bit to experience compassion. And here's how I knew it. This guy that I had talked to on this picnic table outside this clubhouse with tattoos on his neck and a tear coming down his eye, 90 days later, he's picking up his chip and he's talking about how he's gone back to school and he's got full custody of his daughter and he and his dad are starting a business. And I'm in the back of the room just going, oh my God, this is great. And then I got another guy and we're doing pretty good. And then he goes back out and he burns it down. And now this has happened and this has happened. And I find myself tearing up and feeling the pain of the tragedy that he's going through and his family's going through. And I started to develop some real compassion. It starts to get me out of me. And I love it. It's a bright spot in my life today. I love working with guys and I love watching them work with guys. And I love to be a part of that too, where guys are working with me and right in the middle of that. And that's the fellowship that I crave. And it's the fellowship I always craved. I just didn't know it. Somebody had sit me down when I was a young budding alcoholic in my teenage years and said, "Chad, I got great news. One of these days, you're going to get to help." I'm like, forget it. I had no idea what I was in store for. No idea how good this could be. I love it. I've got a purpose in life, and this is it. My purpose in life is twofold, is to grow spiritually and to carry this message, and that's the answer to alcoholism. That's what they found out. That's the big news in this book. It's not optional. It says it over and over. If an alcoholic wants to stay sober and be somewhat happy about it, it's intensive work with other alcoholics. Setting up chairs and making coffee is awesome. That's a great job in AA. But vital to permanent recovery, something we've got to do is sit knee to knee with another alcoholic, get through these steps, and then take somebody else through these steps, and somebody else, and somebody else, and somebody else. Get out there and carry this message. That's the answer, is to carry this message, to work with another alcoholic. That's the secret to recovering from alcoholism, but to do it from a state of surrender. If I can do it from a state of surrender, I can be a vessel for God to work through me to help somebody else. How do I do it from a state of surrender? Well, I got 11 steps in front of step 12 to get me to a state of surrender. It's a superpower, guys. It's a freaking superpower. Do you think if God's working through me to help somebody else, I'm going to pick up a drink? Hell no. Hell no. It's not going to happen. You know, and that's what we do here, and that's why I love this program. I'm so honored to get to be a part of Man to Man and get to stand up here with you guys. Thank you.